What's up, sports fans? What's up, gamers? If by chance you listened to the last extended Power Play episode that I posted right before this one, then you totally know what this podcast is about. In case you didn't, though, well, what's wrong with you? Go check that one out. Just kidding, offsiders. These two pods can totally stand independently of one another. Unlike me. Ha! That was a disability joke, kids. As a person with a disability, I can totally make that joke, but most of you probably shouldn't. But seriously, what is this episode about, you ask? Well, as someone who thoroughly enjoys and thrives with the help of Parasport, or sport for folks with disabilities, I've been really excited to watch the Paralympic Games in Paris this past week. One thing that I know about Parasports and the Paralympics, though, is that aside from the fact that it can sometimes be hard to find places to watch them on, though that's changed a lot this year, as countries have begun to use streaming services to make that easier. The other thing that can be barriers to the general population enjoying the Paralympics is the classification system. The classification system is the system used by the Paralympics, and sometimes higher grassroots organizations, in order to quantify athletes' disabilities. They do this in order to pair athletes with similar disabilities and similar levels of disabilities together so that they can compete together. Doing this ensures that if an athlete loses a competition, it's most likely because of differences in their athletic skill, and not because of differences in disability, over which athletes obviously have no control. That said, understanding classification can be hard to understand from the outside. Heck, it's even difficult when it's being used by the athletes in question. So I decided what I'd do is do my best to make you some episodes that not only explain the rules of some of these incredible sports, but also the classification systems that make them work. That way, next time you sit and watch the game with your friends, maybe you can be a little bit more of an expert than your friends. In honor of the upcoming second week of the Paralympics, I decided that for this episode, I'd introduce you to two of the sports that will start moving into their finals and more into the spotlight this second week. Today, I'm going to teach you about wheelchair basketball and wheelchair tennis, respectively. Ready? Alright then, let's do it. Let's go offside with the Paralympics. Just kidding, guys. I'm really sorry, but if you listen to this podcast at all, you know that no podcast of mine starts without a little disclaimer from me. However, this disclaimer isn't really about swearing this time, and I'm hoping that it also doesn't apply to most of the people who listen to this podcast. One of the downsides of spending time on the internet to watch the Paralympics is that I, and other disabled fans, including people like me who love playing Parasport, have been subjected to listening to the comments sections of the places where these games stream. If you in fact look in some of these comment sections, what you'll find is a plethora of trolls talking about how, because they themselves are able-bodied, they'd crush these elite athletes at their sports. People often speak ill of disabled folks as a whole, claiming us to be, quote, a waste, and all number of terrible things. Two things about that. One, I've seen able-bodied people try some of the sports I love for the first time, and I can guarantee that they struggled to learn at first, just like I did in the beginning. Sometimes, this is also true because the muscles used to excel at some of these games involves upper body and core muscles, which able-bodied folks use far less than in their everyday lives than their disabled counterparts. The second reason why that kind of language is hurtful and, frankly, wrong, is because what you're talking about are in fact elite athletes who've trained for years to excel at their sports. Even if you manage to train yourselves to beat them at these sports, suggesting that you can do that with Paralympians is absurd. That's like saying you, as a road hockey warrior, could beat an NHL star at literally anything related to hockey. Put simply, you can't. All that to say, though, that I encourage fans of the pod and of my content to engage in the comment section, but only if you're willing to do so kindly towards each other and towards me. If I see things like this in my comment sections, I will absolutely not allow those things to go public. Is that censorship? Absolutely. But I won't feel bad about it. Alright, with all the serious stuff out of the way, who's ready to learn some stuff about some of those super awesome Paralympic sports? Yeah, me too. Let's really do it this time. Let's go offside. So unlike the last two sports that I taught you about in bocce and goalball, which didn't initially get a spot in the early version of the Stoke Mandeville Games and the later named Paralympic Games, wheelchair basketball actually has a fairly long history at the game, in both the early games and the Paralympic Games as we know them today. This is especially true when you know that the earlier games were almost exclusively for those with spinal cord injuries. Since we really want to learn about wheelchair basketball, how wheelchair basketball came to be though, how about we turn to some of the people who know far more about this than I do? The folks at the International Wheelchair Basketball Federation. According to them, wheelchair basketball is a made-in-America sport. Which was again initially played by sets of teams in two rehabilitation hospitals in California and Farmington in Massachusetts. Just like the concept of parasport itself, it largely started being played around 1945 in response to so many young men coming home with either catastrophic amputations or spinal cord injuries after World War II. Around the same time that wheelchair basketball was being enjoyed by American war veterans in the US, so too were the patients of Dr. Ludwig Guttmann, soon to be founder of the Paralympic Games, and the patients at his hospital. It's sometimes suggested that the ideal for wheelchair basketball, and standing basketball itself, comes from an earlier game called netball. Full disclosure, I had to look netball up, because even though I knew it existed, I genuinely have no idea how it works. According to World Netball, yes, that's a real organization and a real website, netball seems to me to be a little bit of a cross between basketball as we know it today and something akin to human chess. I know, that sounds really weird, but hear me out. In netball, there are 7 players on the court for each team at a time. The court is divided into thirds, with lines as well as a smaller section which is referred to as the goal section. In netball, each player obviously plays different positions. But, unlike in basketball, these players are only permitted to move within specific areas of the court, depending on their position. The full rules of netball are fascinating to me, and they might deserve their own episode. But the important thing to note for this podcast is that the Americans who were playing wheelchair basketball in California and Boston were playing something closer to modern basketball, while their British counters were playing netball, which I promise you, though they are similar, is a totally different sport altogether. Nonetheless, when the American wheelchair basketball team, known as the Para Pan Am Jets, were invited by the Brits to Europe to play in the now international Stoke Mandeville Games in 1955, the Jets brought wheelchair basketball with them. Surprisingly, the skills that their British opponents had from netball translated well to wheelchair basketball and ultimately convinced the British coaches to convert their wheelchair netball team into a wheelchair basketball team. So now, wheelchair basketball is an international game, baby! Wheelchair basketball was ultimately included in the first official iteration of the modern Paralympic Games as we know them in Rome, Italy. This makes wheelchair basketball one of the earliest and longest-running games in the Paralympics. Alright kids, ready for some rules? I bet you are. Let's go! In the interest of not boring you to your core, I'm going to assume that everyone listening to this podcast at least understands the basic rules of basketball in general. If you don't, I'm happy to leave a link to a YouTube video or something. Or better yet, go watch that 90s movie sensation Space Jam with Bugs Bunny and Michael Jordan. That'll set you straight. I'm just kidding. That was a joke. But I will leave you with an explainer link in the show notes. Okay. So if the rules of wheelchair basketball are pretty much the same as able-bodied basketball, other than the wheelchairs, then what's the big deal, right? Well, just like in most Paralympic sports that have Olympic counterparts, these sports often require slight but very important modifications to make them accessible to athletes with disabilities. Those are the rules I'm going to tell you about. Again, with the help of the International Wheelchair Basketball Federation. These are the rules that make wheelchair basketball just a little bit different from what para-athletes might otherwise refer to as, quote, running basketball. 1. Dribbling. Ever tried to push a wheelchair in a straight line with one hand? Pro tip, you need two hands to push straight. Though some athletes can use their forward momentum of their highly efficient basketball wheelchairs to dribble successfully for a while, this can't be sufficient for an entire game. So, wheelchair basketball players are actually allowed to put the basketball in their lap while they move down the court. The catch is that they can only have two pushes of their chair while it's in their lap before they must dribble again or pass the ball. Likewise, players from an opposing team can try to grab the ball from an opposing player's lap, but just like in running basketball, if that opposing player touches any part of the athlete before they touch the ball, it becomes a foul. Similarly, there is no double dribble rule in wheelchair basketball. That means if the player so chooses, and they have the forward momentum to do so, they can dribble with two hands on the ball rather than just one. A travel violation only occurs if a player takes more than two pushes without dribbling, passing, or shooting the ball. The last part of this might seem incredibly obvious, but the folks at the International Wheelchair Basketball Federation note here that a player will also be called for a violation if their feet touch the ground on the court. That's why, if you watch someone like me playing wheelchair basketball, because I have a hard time controlling my feet on the footplate of my wheelchair, I'll strap my feet down pretty tight so they don't come out during play. Yes, folks who play wheelchair basketball can also have some use of their legs or feet. Those people do exist. It's about levels of impairment, my friends. Levels. Rule difference number 2. Fouls. When it comes to violations, or the assignings of fouls to a player, both a player's wheelchair and their body are considered to be a part of their body. So not only can athletes not foul with their hands, or their voices, in the case of an unsportsmanlike technical foul, they also can't foul a player with a wheelchair. Though, incidental contact certainly does occur in wheelchair basketball, so don't be surprised if while you're watching a game, you see a few chairs banging into each other without a foul being called. Those chairs really are designed to move pretty efficiently, and sports chairs don't have brakes in order to protect athletes' fingers from accidentally being braked on while they're pushing. So those chairs can be hard to stop. That said, here are some pretty wheelchair-specific fouls that can happen in wheelchair basketball. A player who lifts their legs in order to gain an advantage in getting the ball, or lifts their chairs to defend against another player, will, in both cases, be given a technical foul. Again, see why, when I'm playing wheelchair basketball, I wear as many straps as possible to keep the legs I can seldom control from kicking out at people. I just don't want a technical foul. Foul rule 2. If a player flips their chair or lands on the court in a compromised upside-down position and appears to the referee that the player is struggling to get him or herself up independently, the ref may blow the whistle to help the player up and ensure that they're safe. This is why so many players at the elite Paralympic level become fairly skilled at righting themselves should they fall or be knocked over. They're true competitors and don't want any play to stop on their account. This is also another reason why I'm fairly certain every wheelchair basketball player wears seatbelts. If you don't wear a seatbelt and have your body separate from your chair when you flip, you've automatically violated the rule about not having your feet touch the court. So, not only have you halted play because you fell, you've also cost your team a technical foul. Nobody likes technical fouls, kids. Let this be a lesson to you. Wear your seatbelts! Alright, that's pretty much as I see it, the wheelchair-specific rules of wheelchair basketball. But I do have one more thing I want to say. Whenever people have talked to me about wheelchair basketball, which I again will point out is a sport that I'm not very good at, there is also always one thing that people ask me. They'll say, quote, wow, those guys or gals are good, but the nets have to be lower down than them in running basketball, right? The answer, my friends, is absolutely not. The dimensions of a standard running basketball court are 28 by 15 meters, or 91.86 feet by 49.21 feet for our American friends. The basket height is also the same at 3.048 meters, or 10 feet higher for our American friends, which is exactly the same in wheelchair basketball as it is in standing basketball. The foul line and the three-point lines are also in the same place. So the next time that you think that the only reason that dude in a wheelchair was able to hit that shot from his chair is because the net is lower, I want you to check that thought. Because that wheelchair player is 100% using the same 10-foot net that you are. I'll say it again, folks. Incredible, elite athletes. But, Mel, you're saying, you promised that you'd make us expert in classification. What about wheelchair basketball classification? Well, folks, that's what this section of the podcast is about. So in the words of Jock Jams from that all-important Space Jam movie, let's pump the jam and get into wheelchair basketball classification. Let's go back to the info provided for us by our friends at the International Wheelchair Basketball Federation, shall we? Don't want to watch that 34-minute video that they have posted? No worries, I'm going to take you through it here. The first thing that they explain is that an athlete is classified based on a scale from 1 to 4.5, based on something they call volume of action. Volume of action refers to a player's ability to move their body from performing in any type of basketball action back to a fully upright seated position. Here's an example so that makes some sense. Let's say I have a ball and I put in my arms and my trunk in a position to shoot the ball with the ball in my hands. My volume of action refers to how easily I can go from that position back to the position of simply sitting upright in my chair. Make sense? Alright, now on to classes. Like I said above, wheelchair players are ranked on an ability scale of 1 to 4.5. Athletes with lower numbers have lower levels of function. In international competition, a team of players on a wheelchair basketball court cannot exceed 14 points on a court. Alright, now down to the spicy specific stuff. Class 1. Like I said, Class 1 athletes have the lowest level of function on the court at any given time. These athletes have very little trunk control, that's your abs for those of you who aren't anatomy nerds, and functionally speaking, they're unable to pick up the ball with both hands and move back to a seated position without using one of their other hands to help them sit back upright. Class 1s also can't hold the ball out in front of them with both hands without having to fall slightly forward due to loss of control of their trunk. Lastly, Class 1 athletes have little or no ability to rotate or pivot their trunks. Class 1 athletes will also struggle to dribble the ball with one hand without using the other to balance themselves in the chair. They may also dribble in front of their chair while balancing their trunks with the top of their knees. Class 2. Functionally speaking, Class 2 athletes can rotate their trunk left or right and hold the ball in front of themselves without aid. However, they might find it difficult to pick up the ball with both hands and bring it to themselves fully back upright, though they can bring themselves partially back upright. Class 2 athletes most often dribble in front of the chair and are fairly able to dribble from one hand to the next with little or no support from their non-dribbling hand. Class 2 athletes can also lean their body slightly forward, both while shooting and pushing, without losing full stability in their trunk. Class 3. Functionally, Class 3 athletes can hold the ball out in front of them and rotate either to the left or the right or the front. They can pick up the ball with both hands unassisted. However, Class 3 athletes lack a bit of lateral control, so they struggle to act upon picking up the ball that is not directly in front of them. They struggle to pick up a ball that is either to the left or the right of them. The folks at the International Wheelchair Basketball Federation point out that this can be because of either poor hip control or sometimes because of an amputation to one side of the body. Class 3 players have all the more trunk control than their Class 2 counters, and so have the ability to dribble the ball fairly easily while powering their push with the other hand and losing very little energy to extra movement in the process. Class 4 athletes. Class 4 athletes have no impairment in holding the ball out in front of them, nor rotating the ball to the left or the right. They can pick up the ball with no impairment from the front or from the side, but they have difficulty picking up the ball on one side of their chair. Class 4 athletes can dribble the ball far ahead of their chairs with little to no loss of control, and they're able to make fairly sharp turns without a great deal of loss of energy, except perhaps on that not dominant side. Finally, class 4.5. Class 4.5 athletes are the most able athletes on a wheelchair basketball court. They lack impairment in any of their ability to hold or rotate in any direction or pick up the ball on any side. In other words, athletes who are 4.5 have impairments in their bodies that are so largely lower body and are not necessarily impaired in their trunk. A lot like class 4 athletes, class 4.5 athletes have a great deal of trunk support when compared to their peers, meaning they can make sharper controlled turns with no arm support. They can dribble far ahead of themselves and catch passes much further from their chair than lower class athletes. Alright, offsiders, that's about as much about wheelchair basketball expert as I can make you in a single podcast. There are a few more skills that classifiers use to classify athletes, but if I gave you all of them, it might take an entire podcast to do that. Instead, I'll link the video I used to help you in the show notes. One thing that I want you to note here, though, is that while you watch wheelchair basketball, if you ever see some athletes stand up after a game, please don't pass judgment. The folks who classify these athletes are literal professionals at their job, and just because an athlete uses a chair to compete in basketball doesn't mean that they're faking a disability. Likewise, if you ever meet me in a store, sometimes things are high on a shelf and I can't reach it on my own except if I stand up, which I totally will. That doesn't mean I don't need that chair to move around. Okay, I'm off my wheelchair-supported soapbox. Ready to learn one more Paralympic sport? Let's go offside and learn wheelchair tennis, shall we? Some of my friends might be surprised to know that wheelchair tennis is actually one of my most favorite parasports that I've tried. The fact that I'm left-handed is also something that lends itself a little bit to my advantage, as it throws off my opponents a bit to have to defend me from what is usually their weaker side. Enough about me, though. Let's learn a little about the history of this awesome game. So unlike able-bodied tennis, wheelchair tennis, as it's played in modern times, was invented in England. Though some will argue that it came from France, in fact, what France actually invented was a similar game in which players hit a ball with their hands. I probably don't have to tell you, that didn't catch on. What the French did invent, though, was wheelchair tennis, first at a grassroots level, and then later in the elite Paralympic level around the 1980s, according to the International Paralympic Committee. Leave it to the French to take something that was first created an English idea and create their own things. Thanks, France! Now, a lot like the rules of wheelchair basketball that I taught you earlier, the rules of wheelchair tennis aren't that dissimilar from the rules of able-bodied tennis. The only part of tennis that exists for both games that I'm going to explain here is the scoring system. Why? Because it's weird. And nearly every time I'm watching a game, I need to relearn it myself. So I'm going to give you a crash course here. Thanks to our friends at sportingnews.com for making this so easy that even I can understand it. So in tennis, players must win games by scoring 4 or more points. Here's the weird part, though. You ready? The score works like this. First of all, 0 is referred to as love. Why do they call it love? I have no idea. The first point gives them 15 points, and then 30, and then 40, and then the game-winning point. If both players make it to 40, i.e. they tie, this is referred to as a deuce. Once a deuce is reached, the player who wins must do so by 2 points. The first of these 2 points will be listed for this player as AD, or advantage. The last point obviously wins the game, and is referred to as the match point. But to win a game is not to win a match, young Jedis. That is far more complicated. The next thing that a player needs to do to win is to win a set. In order to win a set, a player needs to win 6 games. But just like when they're trying to win a game, in order to win a set, a player needs to win 6 games, but then they also need to beat their opponent by 2 games. So, if both players win 6 games, the winning player needs to win 8 games. In a tie-breaking set, players don't use the traditional 15-30-45 system, but rather, they count just by ones until a player gets to 7. Why do they do this? I have no idea. The answer is to confuse you, I think. Finally, to win a match, a player wins in either a best of 3 or best of 5 when they again win either 5 or 3 games and then again win 2 more sets after that, than their opponents, rather. Then a player wins the match. Is that as clear as pawn scum? If you still find that a little confusing, don't worry. Again, like I did last time, I'm going to leave an explainer video in the episode notes to help you understand the basic rules of tennis, for those of you who don't know. In the meantime, let's talk about the very few modifications in wheelchair tennis that make it different from able-bodied tennis. First off, just as the case with wheelchair basketball, the dimensions of courts, rackets, and the net are all the same in able-bodied tennis as they are in wheelchair tennis. The only difference and the allowances for the wheelchair game are, of course, the wheelchairs themselves, which I have to say are some of the coolest to sit in and use. They turn on a literal dime. The other allowance for wheelchair players is for players who might have an impairment in one of their hands. If a player has a difficulty with physically holding their racket, they may be allowed to use athletic tape to tape the racket to their hand for the duration of the match. The only other difference in the wheelchair game is the 2-bounce rule. In able-bodied tennis, the ball is only allowed to bounce once before it is considered a winning point to the serving player. In wheelchair tennis, the ball is allowed to bounce twice before it's considered a winning point. Other than that, the only thing that I want to mention here is that wheelchair tennis also takes place in all of the other places and tournaments that able-bodied tennis takes place. It happens at Wimbledon, the US Open, etc. The only reason you're likely shocked to hear that is because wheelchair games are seldom broadcast to the general public. I have hope, though, that perhaps one day, with some more exposure, that will change. Ready to learn about classification? All right, let's do it one more time. Let's go! I'm gonna be honest with you, offsiders. For a reason I genuinely can't explain to you, I found it way harder to find info on wheelchair tennis classification than any other sport. That said, what I did find made it seem fairly simple. This is far more simple than the rules of tennis itself, so let's dig into it. Just like a lot of Paralympic sports, but not yet all, wheelchair tennis is open to both men and women. And, just like its able counters, wheelchair tennis has both singles and doubles competition. In the case of doubles, women are also allowed to compete alongside men, as in the able game. That said, when it comes to classification, there are only 2 classes which are able to play wheelchair tennis. But, luckily for athletes like me, and listeners like you, those classifications are both pretty broad and easy to understand. The first class is the open class. According to the Canadian Paralympic Committee website, quote, wheelchair tennis competition is open to male and female athletes with a permanent, substantial, or total loss of function in one or both legs due to conditions such as spinal cord injury, ankylosis, amputation, or other lower limb disability, close quote. Number 2, quad tennis. The quad classification in wheelchair tennis is exactly what it sounds like. In quad tennis, an athlete must have impairment in 3 or more limbs in order to compete. Just one final note on quads, though. It's sometimes misunderstood by those not in the know that quadriplegics completely lack the ability to move all 4 limbs. Though this can be true for some quads, see Christopher Reeves, i.e. Superman, who injured his C1 and C2 vertebrae. Those are literally the highest vertebrae in your body. Still, all it takes to be considered a quadriplegic is to have impairment at some level in all 4 limbs. So some quads can use their arms to play sport. Yep, and some of them are pretty darn good at it, to boot. Like I said, folks, elite athletes. Alright, Offsiders. Just like that, over the course of two very long power play episodes, you're all experts in no less than four Paralympic sports. Though I'd love to do more episodes like this in the future, the Paralympics will sadly end on September 12th, so it's pretty likely that I couldn't get an episode out fast enough to beat that deadline. Nonetheless, if you guys would like to see me explain more parasports in detail, I'm more than happy to do that in the future. In the interim, drop me a comment down below and tell me what Paralympic sports you'd most like to see live. Maybe it's one of these, maybe it's not, but let me know. Well, folks, that's all I have for you today. But as always, I shall leave you with these parting words. It doesn't matter if you're onside or offside, just so long as you're inside the lines. Thanks for listening, folks. I'll see you at the next one. Till then, happy Paralympic Games, everybody! The Two Line Offside podcast is a Sound Shifter production, meaning it's written, edited, and researched by yours truly. Shout out to Queb Sounds of Pixabay.com for the intro and outro of this pod. Lastly, if you think I went offside, or if you think I stayed onside, you can email me at offside.podcast12@gmail.com. See you next time, guys!